614 Startups Nation, welcome to another episode of the 614 Startups Podcast. My name is Elio Harmon, and my mission is to help you attract the clients and access the capital you need to build your dream business. Like a good guest, wipe your feet at the door by hitting the subscribe button and come on in. Today, we're going to be talking about cancer and meeting an innovator whose solution might finally let us say with confidence, F cancer. With that said, I would like to welcome Dr. Xenia Call, founder of Reheva. Dr. Call, welcome to the show.
Hello, everyone. Hi, Elio. Thank you for having me here today.
I've been anticipating this conversation. It's been a long time in the making because this is one of the subjects that I think many of our listeners can relate to because either they've been impacted by cancer or they know somebody who has. And so I want to jump right into the conversation, wasting no time. You're a doctor. What sparked your interest in cancer research?
Yes, thank you so much again. My name is Dr. Xenia Call. I actually came to Columbus almost 12 years ago. I was born in India. I was raised in Japan, did my grad school in Sydney, Australia. But I'm also a daughter of two cancer researchers who've dedicated almost now three decades of their life researching cancer and aging. They fundamentally believe that that was something that went hand in hand. So I was dragged to lab with my parents when I was a young girl. I can't tell you how many times I've been to conferences asking my mom, why am I here today? A lot of my holidays, vacations, spring breaks were generally at conference destinations. So as a young girl, I got to travel the world with my parents. But as I say that, either I could love it the way my parents did, or I could run in the total opposite direction and not really have anything to do with cancer because that's all mom and dad really cared about. But they definitely gave me that spark and passion to continue the work that I do. And for your audience, I want to tell, I'm a cancer researcher. I was trained in cancer genetics. I studied a lot of the initiations, how a normal cell converts into a cancer cell. So that's what I studied during my graduate studies.
That's amazing. You know, my wife and I, we prioritize showing our daughter the world. So she's been to Uganda. She's been to the Netherlands. She's been to Paris. We were just recently in Mexico. So I love the fact that you got to see the world as a little girl and like preacher's kids, right? Cancer researchers' kids, either you're going to become a cancer researcher or you're going to run as far away from it as possible. And so the fact that your background is in research and you have all this training, break it down for us folks who are not in that industry. Where are we in terms of our understanding of cancer, its causes, and how we treat it?
Different people could give you different answers, but I think a lot of our cancer researchers and doctors and oncologists, anybody involved in this space will tell you that we've made significant progress in last decade or two. Cancer, a lot of the advanced cancers are still maybe a death sentence, unfortunately, but we have really made a lot of progress in some of the major cancer types like breast cancer, the biggest awareness a lot of people have. Even in advanced lung cancers, or even just managing the disease long-term has been a motive and a mission for a lot of companies, and from pharmaceutical to small startups to mid-size or whatever. Cancer has come a long way, but still, unfortunately, you know, if anybody's in a situation, and as you said in your early introduction, I used to say, if you're remotely touched by cancer, but now everybody's touched by cancer, whether it's directly through friends, family, whatever. I'm sure everybody knows somebody who is battling cancer even today, right? So it's not something that we think about, oh, it may not happen to us. We live with a fear that we could be sometime, maybe in our lifetime, grappled by this disease. So we think about it all the time. But from a medical advancements, a lot of advancement has happened for some of the major cancers that hit both women and men. From that cancer, lung cancer is on the top of the list. It's a lung cancer really hits a lot of men and women equally. And then when we break it down from gender, breast cancer, prostate cancer, then it's gender specific cancer types we can break down. But I can tell you that cancer has come a long way, and it's not just a lot of the treatments are still toxic. They do have really adverse side effects. But we are making advancements where we can manage the disease long-term. One analogy that I really like to use is about 20, 30 years ago, heart disease was very deadly. But now heart disease can be managed over a long period of time with drugs that are not as toxic. So people can live a generally a good lifespan with a heart disease. And I really hope in long-term, in maybe 10 years from now, that we can make disease like cancer, which is more like a chronic disease, not a deadly disease, which it is kind of for a lot of patients right now. One other thing that I really like to talk about is, it was really funny. So a lot of people in life sciences and healthcare, we go to this conference in San Francisco in the first part of the year, like January 2nd week or first week, we all go to this JP Morgan Chase conference and you'll get all the highlights, everything. I was in an Uber, Uber driving from my one conference destination to the other. And I happened to be talking to this driver and he was saying, oh, are you here for this JP Morgan conference? I was like, yes, I'm a cancer researcher. And he said, 25 years ago, my mother was treated for breast cancer and she's had a longevity, a long life, and she's still living with cancer or without cancer. Maybe she's gone through treatment all along her life. And she said, my aunt was diagnosed with breast cancer last year. She also went through the same treatment my mom did 25 years ago. So that's the two end of the same conversation that I'm having with you. There's been advancement in certain types of cancers, and there's certain specific subtypes of even within breast cancer that are still being treated like 25 years ago. So there is advancements happen in certain areas of cancer. Even breast cancer has seen a lot of advancement, but certain cancers still are being treated how we treated them 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah. Now, you used heart disease as a parallel condition. So let me see if the analogy fits. So when I think heart disease, I think heredity and lifestyle. We don't quite understand it as lay people causation when it comes to cancer. It's either for lung cancer for the longest time, did you smoke, right? That's a risk factor. Did you work in an environment where there were carcinogens, right? Maybe a firefighter or something like that. What do we know today about root causes that we can kind of think about or wrap our mind around? Because one of the things that's scary about cancer is anybody can get it, right?
No, and I'm going to elaborate a little bit again on your lung cancer story. And this is something I deal with every single day. My aunt, who's in India, she's basically practically who brought me up while my parents were busy doing their research in India, 6 years ago, gets diagnosed with advanced lung cancer. And she is one woman who's never had any, she's been on a vegetarian diet. She doesn't like eating out, never smoked in her life. And just at the age of 72, she diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer. How did that happen, right? And as far as I know, you know, she's never been a drinker. She's never drank in her life. She's never smoked. She has lived a generally healthy life. She never was any chronic medication or anything. And that's where the mystery, some of the mystery for cancer is. Yes, you're right. There is a hereditary factor. Yes, there is. We are really, there's some really, really compelling research that really talks about the damages that we as just living our lives are accumulating in our at a more genetic level. Some things we are born with. Some things we just can't control. The environment where we are, the food that we eat, the nutrition, all of these things. Nobody can pinpoint that, oh, you did this wrong, hence this happened to you. It is that cumulative and what we call is epigenetics. These are changes that happen to our DNA at a molecular level that we just can't control by just being who we are. But yes, we can control, you know, some diet, some nutrition, you know, stress, all of that. They contribute. There's multifaceted story to then people have looked at how does that impact our biological clocks or the DNA at a very molecular level? How does that really impact that? But I can tell you, I don't think there's one single factor that contributes to it. Yes, you are at high risk if you have a hereditary genetic marker. You may be at a high risk because you were in such an environment. And on top of that, things that we do in our daily life could contribute to that. But at the same time, I know too many people also, through my practice, through my encounters, who could have done everything perfect in their life and still encounter cancer. One another fundamental thought is that our DNA, are at a cellular level, our cells are dividing all the time. You know, as from the birth, as we are getting older, yes, that cellular clock is ticking and our cells stop or slow down, and hence the aging process as we get older. But as they divide, sometimes they basically accumulate errors. And those errors, if they're not fixed, nothing to do with your environment, nothing to do with, you know, what you did, but those errors are continuously being repaired just as a normal process of our body. And sometimes those don't get repaired the right way. And that can trigger a normal cell into going, becoming something what we call cancerous cells, which is uncontrolled cell proliferation or cell growth.
Hey there, 614 Startups community. We're thrilled to share some exciting news with you. This podcast is proudly supported by Loop, the game changers in return management. Not only are they revolutionizing e-commerce, but they're also on the lookout for talented individuals to join their dynamic team. Looking to be part of a company that values innovation and fosters a vibrant culture? Well, Loop is the place to be. Check out their open positions at loopreturns.com/careers. And here's the scoop. Loop has been recognized by Forbes as one of the next billion-dollar startups of 2023. Want to be part of a success story? Now's your chance. Don't miss out on this incredible opportunity. Head over to loopreturns.com/careers and be part of something extraordinary. Loop, where innovation meets success. Apply now. This episode is brought to you by Rev1. Rev1's mission is to help entrepreneurs build great companies. As you navigate the waters of business entrepreneurship, you don't have to go it alone. A strategic partnership with Rev1 connects innovators to the talent, customers, space, and funding you need when you need it. Get started with Rev1 Startup Studio by visiting rev1ventures.com to learn more. Again, the website is rev1ventures.com. Listen, I didn't intend to go this deep, but Dr. Call gave me permission. Like, this could not go in order, and that's okay. So let's dig into this, because I'm deeply fascinated at this point, because I lost my father-in-law to lung cancer, and he, none of the risk factors, right? It was like, it was late stage when it was discovered, and there wasn't really much that they could do. So you said the replication of cells, we're familiar with the uncontrolled replication, but one of the things that you said is they have errors. So is it both the replication and the replication of the errors that lead to a cancer? Is it it's okay. So it's a double whammy.
There are multiple factors. Sometimes these errors don't get fixed. Mm-hmm. And then those errors kind of duplicate and quadruple and multiply. Mm-hmm. That's one. Or those errors actually did not get fixed also. Even some errors are actually not as lethal, and some errors are lethal. So depending on what errors you accumulate in that cell division process could lead to that cancerous pathway, and others may not. So just depending on what happened in that replication process could lead to an adverse event like cancer over a long period of time, not immediately. It doesn't happen. And that's why we talk about, you know, inflammation, oxidative stress, all of those are those triggers for those errors. So we want to minimize those triggers as we are living our life.
Yeah. So entrepreneurs, beware. Are you creating oxidative stress, right? Don't want to freak you out, but we're all creating a little oxidative stress because we're running companies. All right. So you talked about innovation in terms of treatments. So for some cancers, it's moving at the speed of light and there are multiple options today. For others, it's not, where the same treatment 25 years ago, although effective, is kind of the same thing being used today. And I get this wrong. I thought chemo and radiation was the same thing. So in terms of the range of treatments, you mentioned that many of them are toxic. what's on the most toxic end of the spectrum, and then what's kind of it without getting into, you know, giving away the climax of the movie here, because one of the things you're working on is a solution that might be on the other end of the spectrum. What do we see on the other end of the treatment spectrum?
Yes. So when people talk about cancer treatment, it entails anything from starting from a surgery. You know, some cancers are a really great candidate for surgery, and some patients may be really at a curative intent. So some of the surgeries, if you're diagnosed in early, you know, stage one or stage two, you know, if you're a great candidate for a surgery and the surgery is done with an intent for cure. So surgery can be for some patients very invasive, and some for it's like, oh, it was a surgery that they debulk it. We call it debulking. So take out the tumor, make sure that there was no leftover tumors, and, you know, very nice margins around the surgery site, and that's done. And but that can also be invasive for some patients, depending if you're doing a brain surgery, it could still be having a lot of side effects, you know. So surgery, we talk about chemotherapy. Chemotherapy generally refers to chemicals that we give to patients, you know, and these are basically some of them or most of them are actually not as specific. So basically, when you get these chemicals, they kill everything across the board, you know, from cancer cells to normal to your healthy cells to cells like your hair follicles, which are continuously replicating, you know, or other replicating cells. So they will kill everything across the board, whatever comes in their way. So they're not as specific. And then there is radiation. Sometimes the radiation is very specific. For example, in specific types of cancers, you can really pinpointly give radiation to those very micro, you know, cancer cells, and you will have less side effects. As targeted as the therapy can be, the less side effects you will get. That's generally the philosophy behind some of these. And then we have these new drugs, which are called immunotherapies or targeted therapies. And targeted therapies, particularly, again, my aunt, who is an advanced lung cancer patient, is a candidate for these targeted drugs, that they were able to find a single driver for her type of lung cancer. And we have drugs, and some people are fortunate, like my aunt, who have drug available for that particular driver for that cancer. So she's, and again, targeted, she doesn't have, I mean, she's going through quote unquote oral therapy, cancer therapy, but she has a great quality of life. And immunotherapies are type of treatments which are really training your immune system to recognize cancer cells as foreign and basically have a destruction from there. So those therapies, again, can have side effects. They can also kill people. But if you are a right candidate and you are a great fit, that market in customer fit, if you really are a good fit for that drug, then they can be amazing. But unfortunately, even how much money we've poured into developing those drugs and how expensive those drugs are still, unfortunately, only 5 to 10% of patients actually leverage those drugs. Remainder still fall into some of those general cancer treatments, and as a result, they will have side effects.
Brilliant answer from an expert cancer researcher. I love it. I feel like I have a better understanding of this condition. So we've talked about your background and how you got into cancer research, what the disease is, what the causes are, or you know, some of the contributing factors, and then what the treatment options are. But now I want to talk about you and your company. So what is Reheva, and what problem are you trying to solve?
Yes. So at Reheva, what we are doing is, and I'll actually give you a little bit of a background before I get into Reheva, and that's when the drum roll will happen. Okay. So as I talked about the chemotherapies or drugs that have been used in cancer space for a long period of time, about 40 to 50% of cancer drugs, the chemotherapy drugs that we even use in clinic today, a lot of patients still use them, actually came from nature. So nature has given us a lot of answers. Early discoveries of some of the major blockbuster cancer drugs like Taxol, camptothecin, even painkiller like aspirin came from nature. But what we couldn't do at the time was to have the formulation natural. We had to semi-synthetically make it in the laboratory because we did not have enough plants, or we couldn't have the consistency or scalability that the FDA requires for a drug to be approved for a certain disease. So nature has given us a lot of solution, and we've relied on nature to give us a lot of answers. And that's where a lot of the revolutionary scientific research has come from. And we kept, that was always at the back of our mind. And at Reheva, what we do is we're still developing novel cancer therapies, but that are 100% derived from nature. And what that really means is, when we rely on Mother Nature, not everything is safe, but a lot of, if we've done the good work, we've established that what Mother Nature gave us in a particular plant or whatever is safe. And one of the biggest things that we actually do is, when Mother Nature gives you a solution, it doesn't give you what we call a purified single active ingredient. A lot of the chemotherapy that we use right now is a single active ingredient, you know, single one most active ingredient, take it and it will work. But Mother Nature gives us what we call is a complex mixture. So I like to call it nature's combination therapy. So nature basically has this combination therapy that there are multiple drugs or multiple active ingredients in this plant that can potentially kill the cancer cells in our case and also protect the normal cells. And that's what is novel about our drugs that we are developing at Reheva. Keeping that complexity as one and leveraging that complexity to our advantage of killing cancer cells and protecting our normal cells. And it's and a simple example is, you could either drink orange juice or you could have vitamin C, just the purified compound. So yes, when I do need vitamin C, I need that active, pure 100% vitamin C, this many milligrams. But most of the time, if I can have a freshly squeezed orange juice, that's actually better, because then it has all the antioxidant, it has all the vitamin C's in a mixture which my body can absorb much better. That's what the difference is when we are developing single active agent versus a complex drug like ours.
Okay, so are you just a tree hugger with a fancy title? Give me the science here, okay? Talking about all this Mother Nature stuff.
And actually, I don't know if anybody knows my background here, but the drug that I'm developing is a result of my parents' research as well. And my parents are not plant scientists. I always joke my mother cannot keep a plant alive in our house. So this, and they're hardcore cancer scientists. But what researchers, as researchers, what we do is, we actually have a very unbiased approach to what is presented to us. Hey, there's an agent that's working for cancers. Let's explore it further without having a bias, whether it came from plants or not. I was trained in classic chemotherapies and, you know, these targeted drugs or gene therapy or immunotherapy. I was trained in all the same from my parents. So we don't have any bias. But when you are presented with a molecule or an agent, hey, this works in cancer, let's explore it. And that's where our journey was like, okay, if we do a single active ingredient, it's killing cancer cells, but it's also killing normal cells. Hey, and that's the observation we had. But when we use the mixture, it was still very potently killing cancer cells, but we were able to protect the normal cells. So that's where our journey of that complex mixture really started, instead of being the other way around. And as scientists, that's very critical, because we rely on our data to tell us the truth of the matter.
So we started with the research that exists. And everything I'm saying here is tongue in cheek, all right? I'm a true believer that if you can go the natural way, you should. But given that, right, and so given that that is the vision, to create these therapies that are not only derived from nature, but are in their same natural state, right? It's not an extraction process. It's respecting nature's way of delivering healing. Then, where did you start from? Like, the existing research, let's talk a little bit about that, because then we could see the pathway that Reheva might take to move these existing solutions forward.
Absolutely. No, I think that's a great way of doing it. So again, as and I'll take you really back 13, 15 years when my parents really started this research. My parents doing their own business, you know, my mom used to work for a pharmaceutical company. They worked for the equivalent of NIH in Japan. And I was a young girl still doing her high school and undergraduate first year. So one of the students actually had come to their lab to do a summer internship. And that student actually brought a little tin with this plant material in it and wanted to test that plant material in some of the cancer, what we call as models, like animal experiments or using cells to do those experiments. And this person had never had experience working with human cancer material. So he came to my parents' lab, he or she came to my parents' lab and do this work. And what they found was the first profound discovery was, oh, it actually kills cancer cells and leaves normal cells alone. And I'll tell you why normal cells was very important. As I said in the beginning of our conversation, that my parents are cancer and aging researchers. Had they not been cancer and aging researchers, a lot of cancer researchers would have just focused on the cancer killing properties of this plant material. Because they were aging researchers, we had access to some of the normal tissues as well, just regular age, trying to understand normal aging processes. So had access to these normal tissue material alongside with cancer to test it. So this was a very regular lab practice that we would test any candidate, drug candidate that we were discovering at the time or developing to test it in cancer cells as well as its effect on normal cells. And that early discovery of selective killing of cancer cells and leaving the normal cells really embarked my parents on that journey to continue discovering this plant material that the student had gotten. And what happened after that? The student left after the summer internship, kept my parents busy for next 13 years from that really discovery. And they started understanding one by one, what is in this plant material that is contributing to the anti-cancer properties and keeping the normal cells healthy or in fact making them better. And that research really took them 10 years and they published in highly regarded cancer therapy journals, publications, presented at many, many conferences. And that really is what we call the cellular or molecular biology behind the drug that we are actually in clinical trials now testing in cancer patients. So that was the beginning. And when I came in, I was part of the early research as well. We've tested in a lot of animal cancer models. I always say no mouse should die of cancer. We should at least treat mice with cancer. So we've done a lot of animal experiments, really trying to understand what is that mixture in this cancer cells, in this plant material that is contributing to what we are seeing at a cellular level or in our animal models. And that's something that we do very routinely for a lot of other scientific experimentation for any drug, actually. So when I came in almost 6-7 years ago, this was not coincidental. I always say my mother raised a daughter to commercialize their research. But the need to have something, not natural, the need to have a drug, a cancer therapy, which is as effective, but does not have a side effect, was the need that we were trying to fulfill.
Got it. And it seems like that is the challenge. Because it's not only the killing of the cancer cell, is the protecting of the normal cells, because cancer already wants to do the killing. Why should the treatment aid it in the process, right? So I completely understand. Now, I'm not going to push you too hard on this because some of this stuff might be proprietary, and you've only referred to it as plant material. So I'm guessing that's the proprietary part. Am I right? Okay. All right. So we won't push on that too hard. And so you said you were in clinical trials. There are a lot of life sciences companies being spawned in Columbus, Ohio. Let's talk about the clinical trial process. Like, where do you have to be in terms of the development process to even qualify for a clinical trial? And give us an inside peek into how clinical trials work.
Absolutely. No, I'm glad you asked that question. So what happens is all this discovery and really understanding your drug really happens in the laboratory, mostly either at an academic institution like Ohio State or NIH or any university that has the resources and the time to spend in really understanding the early part of it. And that's where the heavy lifting actually is. Once you know that this drug could potentially be beneficial to human patients, that's, of course, the most expensive. And again, still there's about 10, 12 years of development there. But that is the hard work is also somewhere done in a way. So what happens is when you believe that, okay, we are ready to now put it in patients. We've done a lot of our early discovery work. We understand maybe how it works, maybe because we don't really know until we put it in humans that how does it really work. It's always called proposed mechanism of action. How does it work? It's proposed because we don't know for sure. And we've done all the early work to show that it is at least safe to put it in humans at a certain dose level. Because the FDA is in the business of making sure that if you cannot make people feel better, you cannot hurt them. So the first measure is to make sure that we are going to be okay putting it in patients. So there's a huge, huge actually application that we do with the FDA, and it's called investigational new drug. So once we've done all that work in the laboratory, we've shown that yes, at least it's not hurting animals. We've done a lot of safety studies. We've done a lot of toxicity studies that we at least feel comfortable that we can actually expose a human patient to this drug. We don't know how it will work or even it's going to be safe for human, but at least and on a lot of the data right now will support that you can actually put it in patients. So what we do is we file with the FDA, what is this called, investigational new drug or IND for short. And it's really like a funnel. So there, if you think there's about thousands of drugs being investigated at an academic center or in pharmaceutical companies, and only, you know, maybe tens of thousands really make it to the stage where we think, okay, maybe we should try putting it in animals and make sure that it's safe enough to put it in animals at least, you know, and we're going to get some kind of efficacy. And a lot of them get, you know, finished there. And then even further, a very small number of drugs will actually make it to this IND stage, which is a huge inflection point for a lot of pharmaceutical or biotech companies. As you know, as we're in Columbus, we've got some great ecosystem and, you know, immunotherapies, whether it's like gene therapy or other targeted drugs, you know, those companies are really at that funnel where, you know, yes, these are great technologies and therapies, but are they going to be safe in putting patients, right? Even if it's a rare disease, you know, we want to make sure that they are safe. They could be as life-saving, but if you're going to kill a patient by saving their life, you know, there's no point there. So very small number of drugs or companies make it to that IND stage. And so there's a huge filing that happens. And FDA actually has 30 calendar days once you file with them with everything, you know, all the background, how did you make this drug, all the safety, toxicity, you know, what this clinical trial would look like if they actually allowed it. So there's a huge filing that we have to go through. And FDA has 30 calendar days to come back to you with any questions. And usually they respond on the 28th, Friday afternoon, 5 p.m., and they want the response next day. So they had those 30 calendar days, and then they review everything that, is it even, after everything that you've done, is it even still fit to put it in patients? As they may be dying from cancer, they may be dying from other rare disease, but at that level also, they cannot take a risk. So they will challenge water as well if they could, you know, so they have to be really that higher standard. So once you get that IND, they say, okay, if they allow you to go ahead and now you can do your first clinical trial. So phase one clinical trial, again, a funnel keeps getting narrower and narrower that you could file an IND and an FDA can still put you on hold. It's like, no, we don't believe this is safe. We don't want to risk any of our patients. So whatever makes it through that IND, you're allowed to do your phase one clinical trial. And phase one clinical trial really only looks at the safety and tolerability of the drug. So usually there are three steps, low dose, medium, and high. So you kind of design a study to basically escalate your dosage. Okay, lowest dose, patients were okay. Okay, now we can move up. We move up. And you take the dosage which is most tolerated with least amount of side effect. And that's where you stop the trial. And then you file with the FDA. And if you're successful through that, and again, the funnel gets narrower, you go to phase two. Phase two, what really means is now that you've determined that this drug is safe and tolerable at this dosage, now you're going to expose some more patients at that dose, at that tolerability, to see if this drug is actually working what you're supposed to do. This is the first time you're going to really investigate the efficacy of the drug. And if that goes through, then you go into what is phase three, which is large scale global studies. And that study really allows the drug to be FDA approved. So the phase one and phase two doesn't allow the drug to be approved by the FDA. It's the phase three trials that allow the drugs to be filed for a drug approval.
All right. So you're in phase one right now, or just completed phase one?
We just completed our phase one. Yes.
Congratulations. I know a lot of hard work went into that. So phase two, what is the sample size typically for a drug like this? Just so we kind of get a sense of how many people are going to participate or typically participate. And then what is an efficacy percentage, rate, et cetera, that gets you passed on to phase three?
Yes. So phase two, generally, again, this is to get an early good signal that this drug is working. So anywhere between, 30 to 70, 80 patients are good for a phase two trial. And that also depends on what sort of signal or efficacy signal are you looking for. So if you're looking to make this much difference, then you may need more patients, right? So to show that this is significant and this is actually true, it's not a placebo effect. So there is a lot of biostatistics that happen to basically understand what efficacy signal you're looking for and to that, how many patients we need. But typically phase twos can be anywhere between 30 to 70, 80, 100 patients, just depending on what cancer type it is. And again, if you are working in a cancer type, which is a rare cancer, you may never probably have 100 patients to enroll at a trial. So that's why, in order to de-risk that, we do trials at multiple cancer hospitals or multiple sites, as we call it. So phase one, generally, it's a small number of patients, less than 10, and then you move on to like tens of patients, and that involves multiple cancer sites within the United States, North America, or some may even have to go overseas because the patient number population is such narrow that we need to go global to even get those 100 patients. So it really depends, and that number gets hundreds of patients in phase three. So for example, like COVID, if you remember, when clinical trials were happening, there were thousands of patients being enrolled in every phase. So depending, a patient population that was easily accessible and we needed that kind of thousands of patients to have that kind of statistics to show that this was actually that vaccine was really making a difference in people's lives. So depending on that signal to noise ratio, that could mean that.
This episode is brought to you by KJK. Tired of the billable hour? KJK has a solution. The KJK GC Advantage program offers businesses comprehensive legal services in the areas of employment, corporate services, real estate, trademark, intellectual property, and estate planning, all for a set monthly fee. KJK serves as their clients' partners in business, not just their lawyers. Along with cost certainty and predictability, the KJK GC Advantage program gives clients peace of mind, knowing their projects will be handled quickly and efficiently, maximizing the return on investment on their legal spend. So don't go it alone. Let KJK help. Learn more by visiting kjk.com. Support for the 614 Startups podcast comes from Nationwide. Nationwide's mission is to protect people, businesses, and futures with extraordinary care. To help fulfill that mission, Nationwide is looking to invest its $350 million venture capital investment fund in InsurTechs that will help them create new and exciting products and solutions to meet the needs of their customers. If you're interested in partnering with Nationwide's venture capital team, visit nationwideventures.com to learn more. Again, the website is nationwideventures.com. Nationwide is on your side. Okay. And then what is efficacy, if you don't mind sharing? Like, what are you looking for?
There are multiple things that we look for when we are talking about efficacy. Of course, from a cancer patient, you care about what is their tumor burden. So if they started with a large tumor, was your drug able to reduce that tumor? That's one. Secondly, we look at the time between when they finished their treatment and when the relapse happened. Were you able to extend what we call this progression-free survival? So you finished your treatment with the drug, and now let's see, if you had not done this treatment, you had probably have a relapse in 3 months. But now, because you went through this new innovative drug, not necessarily, you probably had a longer progression-free survival for 6 months. That's something we measure as well. But the two most important things that FDA really cares about is overall survival. Overall survival means that these patients, if they were doing what we call the standard of care treatment, their overall survival was 12 months from, say, diagnosis or whatever that time is. But with this new intervention, now they're actually living 16 months. That's very important to them because your progression-free survival could still be 3 to 6, but they're still dying at 12 months. That's not really what FDA cares about. They care about that, have you improved the overall survival for these patients? Their tumor still could be large and it's not doing anything, right? But they're still living 16 months longer, or total overall survival is elongated. That's what they care about. The second thing that FDA also started to care about is quality of life patients. You could be treating tumors and your scans are showing that the tumor is shrinking, but unfortunately, it's not making a difference in patients' life. Like, they're not able to, for example, if they were bedridden, they're still in the bed. They're not able to do their everyday being. So if you can actually improve the quality of life to these patients, FDA is also still interested. You could be doing nothing to their tumors, but somehow you made these patients feel better. Somehow you were able to measure it. That's when they're interested as well. So those are the kind of efficacy signals we care about.
Listen, I got to keep giving you your kudos because you're making very, very complex federal processes easily palatable to somebody who has no idea prior to this conversation how it works. So I appreciate that. So, I mean, great things all around. It just all depends on what really makes a difference in the patient's life. And number two, what the FDA ultimately is looking for is, are they living longer? But I think size of tumor, the time of progression, and all of those things matter. So if I'm kind of reading in between the lines, there could be a world where these therapeutics live somewhere in that process, where Reheva is a life extension after cancer company or progression slowing company. Your drug is going to find a niche based on how the positive quality of life impact you can have. It doesn't all have to be curative.
It doesn't have to be. I never use the word curative. I'm okay if cancer becomes, as I said, a disease that we can manage over a long period of time, chronically, where people can still have the quality of life. They're able to do what they need to do with living with the disease. And I'll take a moment here and tell you where this whole idea really, where we want to fit in really came in. And this is not, fortunately, not my prior experience, but my co-founder. So my co-founder, Bill Diffendorfer, your Columbus audience probably will know him because he was the CEO of Skybus Airlines. I was not in Columbus at the time, but Bill also happened to be in Columbus. And we were chatting yesterday. He's like, this is my 19th year in Columbus. He never thought he would be here for this long. But Bill was in Columbus, of course, because of Skybus Airline. But then his fiance at the time and now wife was going through ovarian cancer treatment. When we first met at the Ohio State University Fisher College of Business, that's where we met. And she was going through cancer treatment. She was diagnosed. She went through surgery, really long surgery, went through chemotherapy, and she had thought that she had beaten ovarian cancer. And ovarian cancer is pretty deadly, and most of the times it is diagnosed much later. And she had a very active life. And she's like, oh, I've beaten ovarian cancer. 7 months later, her ovarian cancer comes back. And when she had first finished her treatment, and for the 7 months, that progression-free survival time, She was doing her normal, whatever she thought was healthy living, right? She was actively probably not doing anything for her cancer. We knew that cancer was at its lowest point when she finished treatment, but it was probably coming back up. And this whole anxiety of not doing anything about your cancer in that remission period is a real thing. Because you go through such a rigorous treatment and you're monitored, you know, every week, and suddenly you're left alone to go live your life healthy and come back when your cancer comes back, right? And that was her experience. And Bill wanted to make sure that we had something in that time period where patients are still doing something actively about their cancer, that you are actively managing cancer even when you are not doing the active cancer treatment. So, and if you think about it, that's only possible. Unfortunately, we cannot give people chemotherapy for too long because it's so toxic. We have to cut it at 6 or 8 cycles or whatever because it's just a toxic agent. Some drugs, yes, you take for a long period of time because they have a better safety profile. So having a drug which you can take over a long period of time, it is relatively cost effective, because if we are hoping that these patients live for longer and they're going to continue taking it for a long period of time, you hope that it is doing something to their cancer. It's just not a placebo effect. It's doing something actively to their cancers. And thirdly, the quality of life. And there's quality of life for two things. One, unfortunately, a lot of cancer patients have to go to infusion centers or have to go to hospital to get their treatment every 2 weeks, weekly, 3 weeks. And that's not a great quality of life. When you are reminded of the fact that I have cancer and I'm getting treated every single day, it's not a great quality of life. And that plays a huge psychological effect. We wanted something that was oral, that patients can take it at the convenience of their home. They can travel, they can do things, but still do their treatment. And that really were the features of what we wanted in our cancer drug. Not that we can choose, but if we could, cost effective, should be effective for their cancer cell, cancer, can take it orally and doesn't cost you a leg and an arm, is what we wanted for our drug to have.
Oh, listen, this sounds way too good to be true. A cancer treatment that's affordable and natural and doesn't destroy cells that are nearby. Okay, where do I sign? Where do I send the investment check, right? All right. So,
have to sign up for us. But, you know, if you do mean that we live for every single day, and Bill's wife and my aunt, Bill's wife has been taking for 7 years alongside with her other treatment that she was going through, you know, and same for my aunt. As much as the amazing drug that she's taken it alongside with her other treatment. And that's what we talk about. I've never said, don't do any of the above. Do everything that's in your power to make sure. And I can tell you how many oncologists and researchers will agree behind the stage with me that no single drug will treat cancer long term. You know, we know that cancer is such a smart disease. It will find ways to find resistance, to find other ways to move through it and you know, have invasion in wherever they are. So we need multidisciplinary, multiple modalities, like something that we do, something like targeted therapy will do or immunotherapy will do, so that overall we benefit the patient from this disease, from this treatment.
Yeah, yeah. Again, this is, I love it, right? I'm sold. I'm a cheerleader and I'm just being the devil's advocate because I know as you're saying these things, they're so innovative. They're so game changing than the traditional path that a lot of pharmaceutical companies take to bring new drugs to market. And I absolutely love it. So let's say everything goes perfect. Phase 2 goes perfect. Phase 3. What's the earliest you could see this therapy being available to patients widely?
Yes. So again, I sometimes say, I don't want to do a phase 3 myself, because that's a huge, huge endeavor when you think about, because then you're preparing for a commercial after that. So that's when large pharmaceutical companies really come in. You really de-risked the asset, if you will, in this case, or de-risk. We've shown that it's safe. We've shown it's tolerable. We've shown that it could actually work in patients. And phase 3 is really, you know, putting all your ducks in their row, buttoning everything, making sure that your manufacturing is ready, your commercial strategy is ready, you have your sales team who is ready to go. And that's where the heavy lifting and the pharmaceutical companies are really good at what they do. That's where they do well. So my really goal for the company is to do a phase two clinical trial in multiple cancer types. For example, we did our phase one clinical trials in advanced lung cancer patients. We have some really good data to support that this could really benefit patients in ovarian cancer. We have some amazing data in other cancer types as well. So if I had enough money, I want to do multiple cancer types at the same time. And once we come out of these phase two, license it with other partners, big, small pharmaceutical companies, whatever we choose, or and sometimes and our trials are maybe going to be in combination with some other drug. So maybe that's a really good fit for those companies then. And we would go like to go commercial. And depending, FDA will allow some drugs to be given to a wider population if they were meeting the what we call this unmet need, that unfortunately these advanced ovarian cancer patients do not have some amazing drugs to be treated. So give them even today, you know, even after phase twos, FDA can allow to give it to a larger population in a controlled kind of an environment and give it to a larger population that may not be part of your trial. So I don't necessarily just see the end goal after phase three. I can see it at different time points for us.
That's amazing. And so give me your rosiest time point, right? Like if you could wave a magic wand, I know it's not going to be 30 days or whatever, but some reasonable based on, you know, other drugs that have come to market with a similar strategy of going from phase two directly to commercialization. What's a reasonable time frame?
I mean, if we get that accelerated and, you know, right away, it can really happen within like 5 years. But if we don't go, and those are some of the strategies that a lot of companies pursue, the FDA approval doesn't really have to happen on the big indication that we're going after. FDA, you can, and those, and actually there have been two other types of botanical drugs that have been approved by the FDA, not in the cancer space, but they were approved for a very, very niche population. And that's also a strategy that companies pursue, that once it's approved, then you can open it up to other markets as well once it's approved. So sometimes people take the quickest path to market or sometimes the longer path for larger population access. So it's really what we find in our clinical trials, what sort of data are we getting? And this is where, you know, I always say data has to drive some of your decision making. But if everything goes well, you know, if I have all the money that I need in the world, we can make it happen sooner than later.
Well, we're going to come to that point later on in the show about getting you all the money you need in the world in 1 second.
And I don't need millions of hundreds of millions of dollars like a lot of the other life science companies do.
Okay, well, that's a start, right? And so we'll start there. So let me jump in because I want to kind of ask two questions in one. Adoption. Because ultimately, this needs to be signed off by a physician that says, this is appropriate for my patient. Do you find adoption more readily at phase two drugs or adoption more readily at phase three? Meaning, are oncologists, regardless of the stage, risk adverse in terms of prescribing innovative therapies?
So I'm just going to take a pause here. So prescription generally will happen once the FDA really gives you an approval for the drug. But doctors and oncologists can be open to maybe participating in your trial. Hey, you know, like, oh, I'm really interested in your innovative therapy. Can we have this trial at Ohio State also? Can we have this trial at MD Anderson as well? And that generally happens when you are in clinical stage because it is such a rigorous process. So we've come to accept that if a drug is in clinical trials, it must have some legs, right? You know, like, okay, there was some good discovery that happened. At least it is safe in human patients. Let's find out, does it work? But then everybody has their own research interest. But if we can find physician scientists who want to try this alongside with their other patients. So for example, when we did this study at Case Comprehensive Cancer Center in Cleveland, one of the neuro-oncologists, somebody that I don't know, he wrote to me saying, hey, I really think that my patients can benefit from this. Would you be interested in doing a trial in brain cancer with us at Cleveland Clinic? You know, so he cannot prescribe it, but he can design a trial where he can bring in his certain group of patients where he thinks it's going to benefit. And that's where we would do our clinical trials and get enough data. And yes, that adoption is important. The more clinical trials, more patients are exposed to it in a controlled setting, the more data we generate, the better it gets.
All right. So before we go out and raise some funding, which we'll do here in a couple minutes, let's talk about how you make money, because you know that's going to be part of the question as well. We want to make this safe, we want to make it effective, and we want to make it affordable. So what's your business model for this drug? How do you make money?
Right now, we don't. Everything goes out of the company. So we've raised almost $5 million so far. And I'm very happy to always say it came within the 10-mile radius of Columbus. And some of the early funding really came from friends and family, truly people that I know in town or Bill knew, who wrote us checks and believed in what we were developing. And that's where it started. So we don't make money. As a pharmaceutical company or a biotech company, we cannot sell our product right now. So all the money that we've raised has literally gone towards developing this drug in clinical trials, you know, really manufacturing the drug, you know, getting the regulatory help, getting all the animal experiments that we needed to do or clinical trials. So the money is going out. We just cannot bring the revenue in. So a lot of the pharmaceutical or biotech companies are pre-revenue, and our revenue will come a little bit further down the lane. Yeah.
Right. And so once you partner with the pharmaceutical companies, because it's now FDA approved, that's the traditional model, right? So your Reheva is going to license it to the pharmaceutical company, and then you'll be paid royalty on the sales of the drug. How much influence are you going to have, though, in terms of keeping things affordable? Because I know that's part of the mission. So once it's licensed, how do you influence that?
And I think a lot of the high costs for the ultimate drugs that are approved is partly because of the failed drugs cost is lumped onto that one successful one, right? So that's part of the equation. That's not the only equation. The second part of that equation is, and there are many actually, so the second part of the equation is the development cost. If you talk to any life science, your friends in town, they will tell you a post phase one clinical trial with only $5 million raised is an anomaly. So we have been able to use the capital very efficiently to get to where we are today. And a lot of these companies, $5 million, they would have had a burn rate of only a couple months, about that much, right? So that really allowed us to only raise the money that we really needed. Could I have done a little bit more? Sure. I struggled to get where we did, but we did, right? I begged, borrowed, whatever at the time, but we got here. So the development cost, the basically also the no failed drug cost that we don't have, ultimately will help us negotiate and have a better, I guess, economics of this drug in future. So if a drug that people can take over a long period of time doesn't cost you a leg and an arm to get it, and that's what really my vision is, to have cancer drugs that are affordable to a lot of people, is really the driver that we would want to chase.
All right, so I'm kind of weaving through what you said there. Am I hearing that maybe you're not going to have these gigantic royalties? I mean, does some of the cost of the drug kind of trail back to the royalty agreement in the licensing deal that comes from, so every stage tax on their own costs? Am I hearing that right?
Yes. Okay. So far we've been able to negotiate the technology where we got it from, my parents' institution. So we've got some good intellectual property. We've created some of our own intellectual property as well. So hopefully we rely on only our intellectual property to continue building this. So as of the cuts that we have to give to people, if we can limit that, that would be great for us. And if I look at the two other drugs that have been developed and approved by the FDA and has been in the marketplace for a very small indication, not cancer, their development costs were much, much lower than any of the drugs that we see today. I know people love to throw a $2 billion to develop a cancer drug. I'm here to prove that wrong.
Okay. Well, hey, listen, you're breaking ground all over the place. All right. So I'm going to give you a moment here for investors out there who might be listening. What's your elevator pitch, right? Why should an investor reach out to you, right, and join this journey and be a part of it?
Sure. Yes. I don't know if I perfected my elevator pitch, but I can at least say at Reviva Biosciences, we are developing novel plant-derived drugs with little to no side effects. We've completed our phase one clinical trials with really good safety, tolerability, and early efficacy data. We've got some really good partners who want to do or partner with us for future clinical trials. And if that's something that interests them, for the overall good for our cancer patients, I think this will cost them a much less capital than throwing into something that they think is hot and sexy right now.
Awesome. Terrific. I love it. All right. Anything that you wanted to talk about that we haven't discussed so far, I'll give you the final word.
Not necessarily. One thing that I really like to always point about the journey that Bill and I have had with Reviva is I remember sitting with him on Lane Avenue Panera, trying to figure out, we didn't have any office or anything. We bootstrapped and we both casually said, I want to find out if this drug works. And here, 6 years later as well, we just finished our phase one clinical trial. Haven't really proven to the world that this works. We truly believe it does, but we need to show it in clinical trials. So sometimes that, as naively as you say, around a round table can sometimes take that patience, that resilience, which did not come very naturally, but this 6 year journey has really taught me to be an entrepreneur and live and breathe that risk every single day. It's something that nobody can teach you on a piece of paper. You really have to experience it. And I think I feel very fortunate to be raised by parents who have instilled that in me, to have great friends and family and a co-founder who has allowed me to be on this journey.
Well, this is wonderful. One of my best conversations I've had this year by far. So, I'm going to take the final word, and I'm an avid NPR listener on my drive to work. And there was a story about the fact that the ice cream industry is struggling. And the struggles of the ice cream industries might have some parallels here. It might be a stretch, but let's see if I could pull it off. One of the biggest challenges facing the ice cream industry is people want more options. We are of a generation that will no longer accept only what was on the menu. We want natural options. And for pharmaceutical companies like Reviva, who are giving us more choice, we salute you. All right, folks, 614 Startups, that's another episode. Until next time, peace. That's a wrap, folks. You can find this and all our episodes on our website, 614startups.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Anchor, and all your favorite podcasting platforms. Don't forget to subscribe and write a review. If you'd like updates sent directly to your inbox, you can sign up for our weekly newsletter on the website. To engage in the 614 Startups community, follow us on LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at 614 Startups on all platforms and join the conversation. For sponsorship opportunities and collaborations, email us at info@614startups.com.